Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. J. Reuben Appelman cracks open one of America's most notorious murder sprees while simultaneously banging the gavel on his own history with violence. A deftly crafted true crime story with grit set amid the decaying sprawl of Detroit and its outliers, with a foreword by Catherine Broad, sister of victim Timothy King. Four children were abducted and murdered outside of Detroit during the winters of 1976 and 1977. Their bodies eventually dumped in snowbanks around the city. J. Reuben Appelman was 6 years old at the time the murders began and had evaded an abduction attempt during that same time period, fueling a lifelong obsession with what became known as the Oakland County child killings. Autopsies showed the victims to have been fed while in captivity, reportedly held with care, and yet with equal care their bodies had allegedly been groomed post-mortem, scrubbed free of evidence that might link to a killer. There were few credible leads and equally few credible suspects. That's what the cops had passed down to the press, and that's what the city of Detroit and J. Reuben Appelman had come to believe. When the abductions mysteriously stopped, a task force operating on one of the largest manhunt budgets in history shut down without an arrest. Although no more murders occurred, Detroit and its environs remained haunted. The killer had, presumably, not been caught. Eerily overlaid upon the author's own decades-old history with violence, The Kill Jar tells the gripping story of J. Appelman's 10-year investigation into buried leads, apparent police cover-ups of evidence, con men, child pornography rings, and high-level corruption saturating Detroit's most notorious serial killer case. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Kill Jar, Obsession, Descent, and a Hunt for Detroit's Most Notorious Serial Killer, with my special guest, screenwriter and author and journalist, J. Reuben Appelman. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, J. Reuben Appelman.
Thank you, brother. It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much. This is a very, very, very interesting book and very, very deep in terms of all the insidious, like I said, and a web of, as you mentioned, deceit and dissent and perversion. A very, very horrifying and haunting tale. Let's get to that right now. Tell us why this is important to you. We of course mention it, that you were abducted. There was an attempted abduction on you, and you live in the same city, in the same area. Again, tell us why this is important to you as a story, and when you decided to become involved. Tell us just a little bit about your background and why this was important to you then, and why was it important to you later on, enabling you to be able to write this book?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I was a kid in the 70s, 76 and 77. I was, roughly 7 years old during the time of these murders. Four kids had been abducted, held in captivity, and dumped back out in the street after their murders. And at the time, the investigation in my area was thick. It was the environs of these killings, meaning like my hood, my particular little neighborhood, and others like it, were saturated by sort of the nuances of these murders. There was talk of it everywhere you went. It was a part of our common vocabulary and our common emotional sort of landscape and psychological landscape. And at the same time, when I was 7 years old, somebody tried to abduct me. I was in a little shopping plaza in a what you would call a pharmacy, I guess, like a Rite Aid, Walgreens kind of place, although then it was called Century Drugs. And I was shoplifting candy. And I was just, you know, five blocks or so from my house. I crossed a major intersection. I went to this shopping center. I went into the store, and I was trying to steal some candy, and I stuck it down my pants. And as I was doing this, I looked to my right, and down the aisle, maybe 30 feet, was a man who saw me doing this. He was in his 40s. He had every detail of him I remember very clearly. I've never forgotten it. But in brief, he was a larger man wearing a blazer that looked like he was a security guard. Back then, security personnel wore official uniforms. They weren't so much undercover in shopping areas. And I thought, okay, well, I guess I better put this candy back and get the hell out of here. And I put the candy back. I left the store, and I crossed through the parking lot. I crossed back over this major intersection, maybe two lanes each way of traffic, and I crossed into my little neighborhood. And this whole process of getting over there took maybe 10 minutes or so, and maybe a little less. And as I was in relative safety, this man pulled up in his small compact car. I was walking along the grass, the curb, between the grass and the street, a little curb line, and really close to where a car would drive. And he pulled up in his compact car, and he opened his passenger side door, and he reached out for me, told me to get in. As he was reaching out, it was a quick sort of the speaking and the motioning on his part happened concurrently, and he reached over to try to grab me and stuff me into his vehicle. And I took off. I left because I thought I was getting busted for shoplifting. I know now that that's not what happens. I know now that security guards don't travel several blocks in their personal vehicle and track down a child and try to stuff them into their car because he almost stole some candy. At the time, I thought that's what had happened, and I didn't tell anybody because of that. I didn't tell my parents, hey, this guy tried to trunk me, as it's called, if it were his trunk. But and I kept this to myself. Looking back as an adult on these crimes, which was sort of my interest was sort of prompted by this feeling I had had over the years that escalated into like obsession, sort of trying to figure out who this person was who had tried to snatch me. And looking back into that, I realized that there were similarities in the Oakland County child killings and the MO of this particular guy. These four kids had been snatched, or we presume, from very close to, if not right upon these little shopping centers. The car they were allegedly looking for was a compact car. They suspected that the man they were looking for may have been posing as a policeman or security guard or clergy, something like that, because there was never any struggle witnessed from any of these kids. So nobody noticed they had disappeared. All of the things seemed to fit. Now, that didn't pan out to be true when I got into the investigation, but my investigation into the attempted abduction of myself led me to really obsess about these crimes. And the case just took over my life for about 10 or 12 years. And throughout those years, and with the publication of the book, The Kill Jar, my ultimate obligation has been to the family members of the victims. And that means, well, I did write a book, and there's a TV show, and my interest was anchored by my own sort of moment of terror, so to speak. I don't tend to play that up too much in the book. I don't tend to play up my experience too much with the almost abduction, because at the end of the day, mine was an almost abduction, and these four kids were abducted and horribly abused and murdered. So that's what anchors me to the case, but I tend to focus on the book and in my thoughts on what happens after I get interested in the case,
Right. Now, about 2010, that's when you do become more interested again. We'll talk about that in a second, but let's get to the horror that was these child killings, the panic that that ensued with this. Let's get right to the very first victim, Mark Stebbins. And this is February 15th to 19th, as you claim in the book. He was held captive. He was 12 years old. Tell us about Mark Stebbins and what are the circumstances in his abduction.
So Mark Stebbins, he was a 12-year-old boy and disappeared on February 15th. He had been at a work party for his mother in Ferndale, Michigan, a very like a blue-collar neighborhood outside of Detroit, a suburb of Detroit. And let me just preface all of this with saying that all of these kids were abducted from what we rightly call the suburbs of Detroit. But when you say suburbs now, you think McMansions and all this business. Three of these areas are very blue-collar areas back then. You know, it was a suburb, but you jump on the freeway and in 5 minutes you're in the city of Detroit. And I say that, I preface that, because Detroit comes into play later in this investigation in a very important way. But Mark Stebbins, on February 15th, 1976, had been at a work party with his mother. He lived just a few blocks away. He decided that he wanted to go home and turn on the television, watch a movie, and he was allowed to do so because that's what people did at the time. You know, regardless of your age, you could walk wherever you wanted. And, of course, 12, you know, is a relatively old young boy. You know, he's almost a teenager, and of course he's going to walk alone to where he goes. And sure. But he left the American Legion. Yeah, he left the American Legion Hall, and he was never seen again until the 19th, when his body was. So it's 4 days later, and his body was discovered. There are conflicting reports whether or not he was discovered on a low brick wall. Behind a retail district, like a low rent retail district, in Southfield, one city over, or whether he was found in the snow. You know, when you Google this case, man, this is one thing that becomes very important to you. When you Google this case, you'll find all kinds of things. You'll find information saying that all four of these victims were found in the snow, placed on their back, their arms crossed, presented to the world as if gifted by the killer, things of this nature, creepy things like that. In reality, there's conflicting reporting from police documents, from witness statements and such. It's assumed that Mark Stebbins was placed on a wall. At times, it's also assumed at times that Mark Stebbins was laying in the snow near this little wall. What we know, regardless of his placement, is within 10 feet, I can tell you, I can walk out to that dump site and say this is more or less where Mark Stebbins was found. And that's all that at this point really matters. What also matters is that the official narrative at the time was that Mark Stebbins had been bathed. He had been scrubbed clean. His clothing had been washed and pressed. There was no trace evidence, no evidence of any sort that would link us to any kind of killer. The presentation of his body was such that a lone, maniacal serial killer must have been in charge of this situation. Somebody who knew police work, somebody who meticulously took care not to leave evidence, somebody who then also placed the body in such a way as to taunt the police, begging them to try to find him, which they would never be able to do. This was the myth. This was the lore. And the police let that lore linger for various reasons that we can speculate on. But when his body was found, the narrative was such that nothing had been left behind. That's not true, and I'll get into that briefly. I can tell you that there was blood evidence, there was semen evidence, there was saliva evidence, there were fingerprints, hairs, all kinds of stuff, man. So we didn't know this, though, until years later, and I would say nobody really knew this outside of the police force until I and a handful of others started really digging into this case in about 2010, like you say. The next victim was Jill Robinson, also 12 years old, disappeared December 22nd. In a similar fashion, she was on her own. We'll skip to the chase here. She disappeared the 22nd. She was found on the 26th. She was found on the side of a busy freeway, dumped into the snow with a shotgun blast to her head. If I back up a second, I remember to tell you that Mark Stebbins was murdered by asphyxiation. Jill Robinson was on the outside, it appeared that she may have been murdered by this shotgun blast, but there is evidence to believe that she was also asphyxiated prior to that. There's a lot of questioning around this shotgun blast to her face, and many believe, and there is supporting allegorical evidence to believe that she was shot post-mortem. She had, or close to post-mortem, she was possibly asphyxiated, not to death, but to what the killer thought was death. When she was dumped, the killer may have realized she was alive and shot her. She was shot, though, we know, at the dump site, based on blood patterns and such. That was December 22nd. She was missing. Yeah.
Was there a police immediately identify a link between those, or was the shotgun blast misleading there to them?
The shotgun blast was misleading. We know now that there is evidence linking all four of these victims. At the time, the shotgun blast was definitely misleading. Did not know they were looking for a serial killer. They did not speak that way, at least. Less than a month later, January 2nd, Christine Mihalik, was 10 years old, was taken under similar circumstances. She was held in captivity for 19 days. She was not found until the 21st of January. All sorts of evidence points to the fact, in retrospect, when somebody goes back and looks at the files, points to the fact that this was a related murder. At the time, they started to publicly allude to the fact that the murders may have been related because of the proximity and dates, because of some of the similar MO. 3 months later, Timothy King, an 11-year-old boy, was taken after purchasing some items at a small strip mall pharmacy, such as the one I had visited.
Right.
He left, and this is the only abduction that may have had a witness to the moments before it. A witness indicates that Timothy King was seen talking to a man next to a vehicle that was a blue Gremlin. This is a small, compact car. It's blue with a white hockey stripe of paint up its side. And this man and the Gremlin are famous in this case for having made it to a composite, wanted poster with a composite sketch of the man and an image of the blue Gremlin. And this, for all those in the Detroit area who remember this case from the 70s and 80s, this is what is remembered most, the picture of the man and the blue Gremlin. It is said that both of the boys were sodomized with objects, although both boys had evidence left on their bodies that would indicate that they were sexually abused beyond just objects. There was a pubic hair found in Timothy King's groin area, and there was that was not his, and there was, of course, semen found in Mark Stebbins, and You know, their official line is that the girls were not sexually assaulted. Well, there is allegorical evidence as well as news reporting indicating that that's probably not true. There was a debate between the medical examiner and the coroner that had to be re-looked at three different times, this disagreement about whether or not one of the girls had been assaulted, sexually assaulted. And in reality, it's believed, and I discuss in detail the probability that whether they were physically sexually assaulted or not is not so much relevant as the things that tie them to abuse of a sexual nature, regardless of whether or not they were physically violated. You know, you can commit criminal sexual conduct on a child without actually, you know, physically touching them. You can photograph them naked. You can position them. You can, of course, abuse them in many ways that are. And so, you know, there are a lot of investigators at the time who alleged that possibly these crimes weren't even related. It was short-sighted of them. It was lacking common sense in that assumption, and that's the four victims, and then the killings mysteriously stopped. Mark Stebbins, Jill Robinson, Christine Mihalik, and Timothy King, we know were linked based on physical evidence that was left behind on their bodies, but we do not have subsequent killings with similar physical evidence or similar suspects. So it's believed that these four were the only four in under the umbrella of the Oakland County child killings.
Now, you talked about that they had dubbed, the press had dubbed the killer as the Oakland, or these killings as the Oakland County child killings. But very interestingly, the media, I guess, had named him. What was the name they gave him and why?
Well, the name they gave, quote, him, as you say, although, as I discuss quite frequently in the book, I don't believe there's a singular killer in this instance,
right.
or at least other people were complicit and knowing. But the name they originally gave, quote, him, was the babysitter, because of the continued narrative that these bodies were clean, they were scrubbed free of evidence or debris, their clothing had been washed and pressed, the children had been fed while in captivity. So this indicated to the press and to the police initially that this was an unusual type of murderer. This was a person who cared for the kids, who coddled them in some ways for compared to the usual standards of known serial killers and such. But I say to you that, if you're holding somebody for 19 days and you want to continue to abuse this person for 19 days, well, that person needs to be fed. If you are holding somebody for 4 days and you want to continue to use them in certain ways, it's very possible that they should be fed.
Sure.
You know, and so I think the press, it appears that the press made a lot out of a little because they were they were looking for headlines, and the police did not do much to dissuade them from these kinds of narratives. Now, we will have to look at why the police didn't dissuade them from those narratives. The one thing that was of interest to police specifically, and this is, I think, when the babysitter lore really took over, was Timothy King's parents made public pleas to the killer, both on television and in print, to return Timothy to them, and one thing they said was, "We're waiting to bring you home and feed you your favorite dinner, fried chicken." Is something they mentioned, and
right.
Timothy King was found with fried chicken in the contents of his stomach, indicating to police that the killer had watched that broadcast or read that article. I can't remember whether it was print or TV at the moment, but that article or news story had allegedly filtered through to the killer, and the killer seemed to care, you know, and give Timothy King fried chicken, and that's possibly true, man. You know, I mean, maybe the killer did think, well, might as well give him fried chicken, you know.
Jeez.
But you know, the babysitter, we say the babysitter, but it's very clear that these kids were violated horribly. And so the real narrative of the Oakland County child killer, that became more prevalent. The babysitter is something that lingers in splashy headlines on old blogs or topic threads and things like that, but it's not something that very many people in the know really refer to very much.
You write about how serious the police response is this, and the response from the public via the media, and so tell us how police proceed. They have this sketch, and they have the blue gremlin, and they do talk, it seems, in the press about being pretty confident. How do they proceed?
Well, interestingly enough, at the time, this was the in terms of resources allocated toward a contemporary murder investigation, this was, at the time, the most funded investigation in U.S. history. There were something like 300 investigators actively working this case. Wow. There were FBI personnel. There was county cops. There were city cops. I mean, there were people from across the board had flooded in. They established a task force, first in a little building, then in a bigger building, and they had an active, full-on buzzing hive of a task force investigating allegedly thousands of tips. Something like 20,000 tips were called in the initial years of the investigation. However, two of those tips that were investigated, numbers 369 and 370, were related to two prime suspects who continue to be the prime suspects. I'm going to back up and just tell you what happened with them initially, and then I'll talk more about them, and then I'll talk to you about how this investigation shut down. Initially, Christopher Bush and Gregory Green, two people who had been being charged with criminal sexual conduct charges throughout the state against minors throughout the state, had been called in as tips. They were believed to be by outsiders who had called them in to be associated with these killings somehow. Christopher Bush and Gregory Green were called in and questioned. These are people, I'll give you a little background. Gregory Green had come from California in the year prior after having served a short stint in a mental institution for a conviction of 50 counts of criminal sexual conduct against children. One of the children he had sexually assaulted, he had asphyxiated, he was not putting his hand over the kid's mouth, he was not sure if the kid was alive or not. He burned him with a cigarette several times to see if he was alive. He still couldn't tell. He drove this boy to a hospital and dumped him on the grounds and then drove away. That's one of his victims. So remember, Gregory Green sexually assaulted a boy he had just taken for assaulting him. He had closed his mouth to the point where the kid passed out, and Gregory Green had dumped him off in public and taken off. He ends up doing a year in a mental ward and a psych ward, and comes to Michigan, where he meets up with Christopher Bush. Christopher Bush is the son of a wealthy General Motors executive at the time, and you have to remember General Motors, or the auto industry in general, was the epicenter of wealth in our country, similar to the tech industry in Silicon Valley or to the oil industry in Houston, something like that, the way we think of those areas. Detroit was one of those epicenters back then, if not the largest at the time. In our country, the millionaires of the time would probably be equivalent to the billionaires of our time today. Right. And Detroit was an area full of these types of millionaires, and certainly full of millions funneling through that economy based through the executive level of that economy. And Christopher Bush was the son of that executive level of economy, right? And Christopher Bush and Gregory Green had sexually assaulted dozens of children a little bit north of Detroit in certain areas. And had been called in as suspects in this case. They were brought in for questioning. They took polygraphs. It was said that they passed those polygraphs and there was no more interest in them as Oakland County child killer suspects, period. Christopher Bush, something like a year later, allegedly commits suicide. And very shortly after the suicide, and Gregory Green goes to prison for the criminal sexual conduct charges. Christopher Bush never made it to prison, although I can also say that he wouldn't have. He had been given probation on charges he had been currently facing. For those same charges, Gregory Green, his compatriot, got life in prison. This gets a little complicated, but I'll slow it down and just say that Christopher Bush allegedly commits suicide. And very shortly after, this massive hive of a task force comprised of the FBI, the state police, the county cops, and the city cops from places like Ferndale, Berkeley, Southfield, Livonia, and Detroit itself, all of this buzzing hive of activity of investigation shuts down. They pack up and they move on. Very shortly after Christopher Bush allegedly commits suicide. Throughout the years, other suspects are looked at. They're tied to other criminal sexual conduct charges with children. They're tied to pornography syndicates. They're tied to all kinds of things. These suspects are looked at throughout the years. Nobody is ever found to be, allegedly ever found to be associated with the Oakland County child killings. But roughly around 2010, thousands of pages of FOIA documents are received through Barry King, the father of one of the victims, Timothy King. Thousands and thousands of pages, and when I say pages, I mean crime scene narratives, autopsy reports, internal departmental narratives, evidence catalogs, all documentation from the case related to Christopher Bush specifically is received by Barry King. This information, this stockpile of maybe about 5,000 pages or so becomes the focal point of my investigation after it's handed off to me from Barry King. And I can say without a doubt, without a shred of questioning about whether or not I know what I'm looking at or something, that without a doubt, Christopher Bush and Gregory Green should have been looked at much, much more thoroughly at the time, as well as other players related to what I alluded to in a pornography syndicate. And I believe at this time, under today's current prosecutorial standards, this case could be solved today, if not, and probably was already solved. That most of the information that would have led the police or the public or the press to focus on viable suspects was buried or misdirected or shoved away or quote lost. There is evidence in the case that is, quote, lost, documentation in the case that is, quote, lost. And if you were dealing with a small-town investigation who wasn't used to doing things by the book, this would be expected. But we are talking about the largest murder investigation in U.S. history at the time that had FBI involvement, state police involvement, multiple counties involved, and multiple cities involved. And Some of the key evidence has allegedly been lost, and some of the key documents are either lost or highly redacted when viewed. And so there's a lot to talk about. But I can say your original question, probably 10 minutes ago now, was how did the police investigation proceed? And it proceeded as if the way you would expect 300 people to proceed if they were not given adequate information. So I don't blame active police officers working this case at the time for what they didn't know. There are plenty of fantastic cops working this case at the time and continue to. There's an officer named Jack Kalbflash who is retired right now and continues to work this case in his spare time. I met with Jack Kalbflash, and unfortunately it was discovered that I have documents from back in 76 and 77 that he never saw, although he was an original task force member. So I have key evidence-based documents sitting in my possession, right, that one of the lead investigators on this case never saw, although the documentation existed before before he left the case. So you have the most highly regarded key figures in the case not being provided the information they needed to solve this case, and that's how this police investigation went, and the question remains why.
Tell us about, let's get into this, because there's some fantastic claims, and you've done an incredible investigation into this. So let's talk about Christopher Bush's death. You say it was ruled a suicide, and that just disbanded this task force. You discussed that suicide, and you questioned that. So tell us about that. What's the question?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you read the book, and I'm glad you're not, you know, it's nice to know that you actually read the book, and we discussed the investigation a little bit before we got on the horn together, and that's why I feel confident saying, okay, he knows what, you know, it's good that, you know, that you're picking the right questions is what I'm saying. And Christopher Bush is, you know, at his suicide scene, the police show up, and he kills himself in his bedroom, his home bedroom. He's in his 20s, but he was in trouble. He was under investigation, so he's staying at home. He's got to meet with lawyers that his family's paying for and such, so he's living at home. And his parents are in Europe, and he allegedly shoots himself in the head with a rifle. A housekeeper shows up, can't get into the house. She hears the dogs barking. She says something suspicious, she thinks. She doesn't know why. She can't, you know, she doesn't say, I mean, if you show up and you can't get into a house, it's not necessarily suspicious. You just can't get into the house. But she calls Christopher Bush's brother. The brother then calls the police. The brother doesn't say, oh, I'll go over to the house and see if everything's okay. He calls the police first, then drives over to the house, and he meets the police at the house. They get into the house. They find Christopher Bush dead in the upstairs bedroom on his bed. This is the narrative. What really happened, I'm not speaking to you. I'm telling you what the narrative is. The narrative is they go upstairs, and they find Christopher Bush dead on his bedroom in his bed. On the wall, tacked to the wall, in his bedroom is a pencil drawing of Mark Stebbins screaming in pain. Now, it doesn't say Mark Stebbins screaming in pain, but it's a drawing of a boy wearing a hood who is spot on for Mark Stebbins. And Mark Stebbins was, allegorically anyway, said to have been found with his hood up. We have a drawing of the first victim. We have ropes found in his closet, ligatures. And not only is there no blood splatter around Christopher Bush, who was allegedly shot with his .22 rifle by himself, I mean, allegedly shot himself. There's no blood splatter. All fingers, all body parts in proximity were tested for gunshot residue. There's no gunshot residue. There's no blood splatter. There's no gunshot residue. There's a photo. There's a drawing of Mark Stebbins. There are ligatures found in his room. Seem to be set out. The drawing seems to be displayed. The ligatures seem to be displayed. Immediately Christopher Bush's death is labeled a suicide. In the same moments, that same day, it's closed. His father comes back from Europe. The body is cremated. The gun allegedly used to kill him, to kill Christopher Bush, is given back to the father. Is released to the father. The father has written an IOU, says, I will give this back to the police at some time in the future. But they do not keep the gun. And you say to yourself, why does this matter? Why does this matter that police keep the gun of a suicide victim? Well, yeah, it matters because behind the scenes of this suicide victim, behind the scenes, you look at the document now, which nobody had back then, Christopher Bush was actively being looked at as a suspect in the Oakland County child killings. In fact, his partner, Gregory Green, had turned him in as the killer, had said during Green's interrogation, Christopher Bush killed the Stebbins boy. He said that to the police. Police let everybody go because they passed polygraphs, allegedly. But the point is, very recently, he had been actively looked at as a suspect in the killings of four children. And here is a gun, and here is a picture of one of the dead kids, and here are ligatures, and it was said that the boys were bound based on autopsy reports or coroner reports. And they let this gun go. Why do they do this? For the same reasons they immediately allow it to be labeled a suicide. For the same reasons the father is allowed to cremate the body before any further investigation into possibly the DNA. I mean, they didn't have much DNA stuff back then, but the collection of hairs or such from Christopher Bush. Christopher Bush was a main suspect. He killed himself. He's got evidence, circumstantial evidence, indicating that maybe he was involved. There's this image of Mark Stebbins on his wall, and basically the police turned their backs on this scene, which was no doubt a crime scene. Whether it was a murder or a suicide, it was a scene that should have been investigated further, as a crime scene would have been investigated. It should have been handled with the utmost care. They're talking about a prime suspect in the killings of four children that hundreds of investigators have been dedicated to looking into. So it doesn't make sense. It defies all logic, this suicide. And the fact that it's labeled a suicide also defies logic. And that's just not me. That's any serious investigator looking at the the suicide report. In fact, I recently met with a criminologist in Canada as part of this TV show that's being filmed, and we went up to Western University in Ontario and met with this guy who had done his own analysis of the suicide scene and concurred with everything that I say in the book, and so does Jack Kalfleisch, and so does anybody who really touches this case with a serious eye. It's impossible to believe that this was just a suicide. It looks more like it was a murder, and then you have to say why. And that's a different part of the story.
Absolutely. You talk about, and you fast forward back and forth, and now in 2010, you're looking, and after that, you're looking at all of the documents and photos and all the incredible information that you have via Barry King. And you're looking at a photo, and you see have Timothy King and an art dealer and another person, and there's a news article later. Tell us what starts to unfold. It seems to point in a direction, again, far, far more insidious and horrifying than the story seems to have been so far. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what begins as the narrative of these killings is that they're serial killing by either one or two people or something. You think why? Well, maybe for their own personal advantage or sexual appetites or whatever. And even if the initial narrative is still at that time back in 70, all the way through the 80s, all the way through the 90s, all the way to 2000. And, 8, 9, 10 is for three decades, basically people are looking for one person. As I start to dig in, it looks like maybe there's people involved here. Maybe there's two people. And then as I really dig in, and you mentioned this article, because the article is the sort of redirect for me, which leads me to the Cass Corridor in Detroit. The Cass Corridor at the time was a very impoverished area, one of the most impoverished areas in our country, teeming with prostitutes and drugs and all the things that come with areas that are socially and fiscally deprived. And in that area, there were several prolific child pornography consumers and distributors and pornographers and makers of it as well, and in that area there are found to be a couple of people who it looks like have ties to the Christopher Bushes of the world, Christopher Bush specifically, as well as the people in suburban Detroit. And those pedophiles in the interior of Detroit, in this dark, teeming sort of underground, are later found to have been prolific molesters as well, and several of them are in prison. Ted Lamborghini goes to prison for child molestation. A man named Richard Lawson, who is later found to be and previously and later found to be tied to many criminal sexual conduct events, but is put away for a murder. He of a grown man. He is also a prolific pederast, and then interestingly enough, in the heart of Detroit, there appear to be links to this most insidious part of the case in northern Michigan, in an area called North Fox Island, which is a small island off the western coast of Michigan, in Lake Michigan. There was a man named Frank Sheldon who came from Detroit money. He was a millionaire at the time. He was heir to the Grosse Pointe mansion developers. He was heir to the tycoon money of the richest areas of Detroit. And he owned this small island several hours north. And he ran a boys camp on this island, which was set up to look like a camp for troubled youth. He would have these children on the island. He would receive federal and state subsidies for doing this charitable work of running a camp for people to rehabilitate their sort of their troubled pasts out of them. And but in reality, this camp was run as a molestation and pornography mill by Frank Sheldon and several of his partners in this, one Dyer Grossman and Gerald Richards and a couple of other people. These people up in this northern part of Michigan took in boys to this place that was only reachable by airplane in the winter or ferry in the summer. So once these children were on this island, they were trapped on this island with these older men who routinely molested them, photographed them during these molestations, set up photo shoots, as it were, and abused them for their own sexual appetites and reasons, but also pumped out that pornography into the greater world of child pornography consumers that stretched back down to Detroit as well as to the east. And this was the beginning of what later became readily seen as other pornography mills / camps / whatever you call it, people running things like church camps and such, but they were really for these purposes. And we later discovered through FBI documents and such that the proliferation of this type of thing was wide, which was scary to find out. However, when you mention that article, it basically is the article that indicates to me that the possibility, just from a gut feeling, that something might have been off in our original look at the case, that the what we called the isolated murders of these children were not so isolated, that they were tied possibly to this larger pornography syndicate. And after I started with that, after that gut feeling, I started looking in that direction for documents, and sure enough, plenty of the documents indicate that, specifically in Timothy King's instance, that there were Timothy King was likely alive and passed to other pedophiles of the time. We can also believe that based on evidence from the clothing of the victims. Now, on our most recent looks, we have physical and allegorical evidence, but focus on the physical because that's what the police want and that's what's there. Evidence to show us that multiple people were involved in these crimes. Now, we say, okay, we know this is true because we have multiple hairs from different parts, from different people. And I say, not just random people. There is a known pedophile who is currently serving time, who had hair evidence pulled from his vehicle that is not his hair, though. It was somebody he was rolling around with that matches the bodies of two of the victims. We have the same carpet fibers on all of the victims. So we have, and then we have hair from another person that matches one of the other victims. So we have multiple people with multiple hairs matching multiple bodies. Everything points to the fact there were multiple people involved in these crimes, and these people also happen to be involved in those pedophile tentacles. So they're child pornography tentacles, I mean to say, that stretched back and forth between North Fox Island and the Detroit area. And it's very, very troubling once you look into it like that. But the evidence seems to point in that direction.
We can use this as an opportunity, Jay Rubin, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor of this program, Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. You spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Casper offers two other mattresses, the Wave and the Essential. Affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you. Delivered right to your door in a small, how-do-they-do-that size box. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. And you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. I received my original Casper queen-size mattress. It came in a real small box, but it was easy to take out. And right from the very first night, my wife and I truly experienced a much more restful sleep. Now we just expect that we'll get a great, comfortable, uninterrupted sleep every night. We're very happy with our Casper mattress. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/truemurder, one word, and using truemurder, one word, at checkout, using the promo code truemurder at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/truemurder, and using promo code TrueMurder at checkout. Now, Jay Rubin, you've, with your incredible investigation, you have, as you coined it, termed it, the tentacles of a far more reaching and, again, the only word I can almost say is it's an evil organization featuring some people with money and connections. When I mentioned that article that got your mind reeling, there was a Birmingham police officer, a former head of General Motors, Ed Cole, you said, and Timothy King at that time, and an art dealer, John McKinney.
Mm-hmm.
Again, continuing with how deep this goes, and of course it wasn't just, again, like you say, isolated cases of a serial killer gone run amok, a far more organized thing. And we talked about Chris Bush's apparent murder rather than suicide. Continue with the links that you investigate and some of the other mysterious deaths that occur in connection to this.
Yeah, the article you're specifically referring to had what appears to be a coincidence on first glance. You know, there's it's an article that says it's basically like notable events of the year, you know, and just a local article, and it pictures Timothy King, Ed Cole, like you say, who the former head of Ed Cole's plane goes down, and he dies in a plane wreck. McKinney, who you mentioned, who is an art dealer who dies in a mysterious murder, and Randy Lalick, who is Birmingham's first police officer. These people are all just put in a place in a line. As you see, as you'll find in the book, my hunt for Reni Lela turns out to be, I stop hunting. She's alive, but McKinney specifically is somebody who I followed a little bit in the book, and it turns out that McKinney has ties to the Detroit underworld. I at that time. And McKinney also knew and was in close proximity to a couple of the victims. This came to me later in the investigation. But I don't want to say too much about him right now because he has living relatives of the area who are not, and he has not been actively investigated or charged with anything in the past. He was not a suspect. But his murder, I will say this, his murder, which remained unsolved, is something that appeared to be related to the same underworld of the time. He was involved in, sexual, what would be considered sexual deviancies of the Cass area, and I don't want to say very much about that because, like I say, his living family probably deserves the respect of me not talking too much about him since he was not actively investigated in my book. But I want to say this, and I think this is the larger point that you're getting to. The tentacles of this case reach widely, not just to Fox Island, not just to the Christopher Bushes, but the world at the time, the world of Detroit at the time, had like three layers. It had, but very intensely three layers. It had your middle layer of just common folk working their jobs. It had the upper layer of these executives, profiteering, and then it had this underbelly, right? That was bigger and wider and thicker than the underbellies of the criminal organizations that you imagine of today. I mean, it was everywhere, like mushrooms, how they spread underground through a field for miles. It was like that. The roots were everywhere. You pull up one of these mushrooms, and if you could do so without tearing all the roots, they'd all be connected, and you'd have this godlike hand with a mass of mushroom roots miles long and hanging from it. And that's really what this case is. When you pull up on the Christopher Bushes and the Gregory Greens, what trails behind is so many things, so many connections to what appears to be continuous abuse for years by pedophiles who were ignored. And what at the top, though, the hand pulling up, I would say in this metaphor that I'm just making up, so forgive me if it doesn't pan out, but the hand pulling up is something like what we all imagine the political powers that be to look like. This is the hand of the H. Lee Bushes, which is Christopher Bush's father, which is the high money, politically entrenched hand. And that hand, the thing is, that hand will do anything to not pull up on that root system. And that's really what happened with this case. And I don't want to spend a lot of time telling you about the 25 different pieces, the mushrooms and the roots and the whatever, but I can tell you without a doubt, whether or not somebody was found guilty back then unofficially is irrelevant. This case was intentionally quashed. It cannot be otherwise. When you look at the documents, there's so much information pointing to very, very prime suspects. And the police will tell you, and again, I love the police. I think they do fantastic work when they're allowed to do it. But when you look into the investigation of this case, all the way back to the beginning, 76, 77, 78, the 80s, you see all sorts of very substantive leads, substantive you know, leads that would be followed today with all the resources available to us. They were concealed from the public. They were concealed from the public, these leads, and not for the sake of maintaining the integrity of the investigation, which is the standard line that the police will tell you. They will say, and I say police, it's a broad term to say the lead investigators, the prosecutors, whatever. They will tell you, we cannot talk about this because it compromises an open and active investigation. It's a line of crap. It's been 40 years. They will tell you this stuff has been buried because it would compromise our investigation, our 40-year-old investigation that we allegedly have made no dents in. That's not true. They will tell you that because they're told to tell you that, and because some of them believe in that still. The reality is that this case was quashed to protect the identities of parties who were complicit in these crimes, because the identities of those parties, in some instances, lead back to the power structure or lead back to the entrenched wealth of the family member of one of the victims, or lead back to, you know, your Frank Sheldons, who this guy was, we're talking about a guy on North Fox Island who absconded from the United States, evaded investigation, and remained a millionaire living in the Netherlands, evading extradition for the rest of his life and no doubt molesting people in the Netherlands. This is a guy who was among the most powerful, the most elite of Detroit at the time. And Christopher Bush had connection to Frank Sheldon, and all these players that were at the top rungs skated from at least being labeled the Oakland County child killer, or at least being labeled and complicit to the killings. And I'm not saying Frank Sheldon was the Oakland County child killer. In fact, he had already absconded at the time. He was not the Oakland County child killer by all, you know, practical looks. He could not be that person.
Right.
But when you pull up that root system, it exposes all of this other stuff. And at this time in Detroit's history, that stuff was not meant to be exposed, and so it was not pulled up.
Tell us about this. Again, you talk about the root system, but just for an example, you go so far deep to the Boy Scouts of America. If you can get anything more sacred and then evil at the same time here with this revelation. Tell us what you find, again, with this Boy Scouts of America and this connection to somebody who was in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah. You know, just like with the Catholic Church, and I don't spend any time on the Catholic Church really in the book because
no.
it's a well known already, and we're finding out more every day still. And also the Catholic Church, you know, it's not really a part of this story, but this particular story. But the Boy Scouts of America has this file called the Perversion Files that it's labeled, and basically it's a parallel to the what we know about the Catholic Church. For decades, children had reported their abuses to at the hands of scout leaders to the upper echelons of the Boy Scouts Corporation, or however it's run, and those files were kept, but they were quashed. Just like in the Catholic Church, scout leaders were like quietly removed, or they, in some instances, they were quietly repositioned to another troop, but taken away from that area if they wanted to be a scout leader or something. But the perversion files chronicle thousands of cases of molestation, not very widely talked about for some reason, but clearly very well known, and known enough that you can just get online and Google the perversion files of the Boy Scouts, and you'll find information. And what I found when I started looking into the Boy Scouts through association with one of the other characters you talked about previously is Ed Cole. I'm not going to say Ed Cole had anything to do with anything at this point. I don't identify him as a suspect. I identify his some of the circumstances of his life as somewhat suspicious, but I also identify that as possibly being a part of that larger rabbit hole that I mentioned falling down. Once you look into this case, your mind starts going haywire for a while, and you think, is this right? But when I got to the Boy Scouts, I landed on something pretty serious to me, not just the the perversion files, but that one of the people named in the perversion files as a perpetrator of these molestations was a guy who, under a previous last name of McConaughey, had molested a bunch of kids and was identified as a problem for the Boy Scouts. He later changed his name to Adam Starchild, which is very interesting. And Adam Starchild later became a financial counsel to Frank Sheldon during his time absconding from the U.S. Prior to being charged with crimes on North Fox Island. So Adam Starchild, this is the thread you're referring to. Adam Starchild was named early on in the perversion files of the Boy Scouts, and also owned a travel agency for young boys. It was basically like what a lot of people do nowadays in Eastern Europe. You know, travel agencies, quote, are just shell companies to traffic people. And and Adam Starchild owned a travel agency. He actually was a verified member of Mensa, a very intelligent guy, clearly. And he winds up in cahoots with Frank Sheldon, the owner of North Fox Island, the pornographer and child molester scumbag, who relies on Adam Starchild for a very short time to figure out how to get his personal wealth over to the Netherlands without it being taken by the feds or whatever you want to call it. And so Adam Starchild then also disappears, and as recently as a little over a decade ago was living quite well, writing books on how to evade taxes, how to set up a double identity, how to become essentially somebody you're not, and was selling these books legally online, and was associated with a press that was like an underground illicit press that ran like, you know, boy love type of articles and things like that. And, you know, these are some sick, sick dirt bags. And the thing is that at the time they all knew each other because they had to know each other, because there was no internet where they could like connect digitally and get what they needed and whatever. These people like had personal connections via telephone and personal interaction and actually showing up and being present with each other. They knew each other intimately at the time because that's how you did things back then. You know, it's interesting now when people want sick things, they just find it in anonymity online. At the time, they had to reach out and put themselves out, and they clearly weren't going to do that with just everybody. So there was a syndicate of people like Adam Starchild. It makes sense that he knew Frank Sheldon and helped him. Now, Frank Sheldon actually later tried to sue Adam Starchild or something like that from overseas, because Starchild actually embezzled some of Frank Sheldon's money, which is of little note to this case, but it shows you the type of people we're dealing with. And also, Adam Starchild is indicated as in relationship to the Abscam scandal of when you look into that, which is also unrelated to this case, so I don't want to go on too many tangents, but Adam Starchild is a very interesting character, and it all starts for him as a scout leader of troop whatever in Minnesota, I think it is, molesting children. You don't look at Frank Sheldon without looking at Adam Starchild, just like you don't look at Christopher Bush without looking at Frank Sheldon, just like you don't look at Ted Lamborghini without looking at Christopher Bush. And Ted Lamborghini is a living incarcerated man right now who's doing time for child molestations that took place back in those days. And you know, he appears to have information about this case. There are also other people, an Art Sloan and Vince Gunnels, who appear to have information about this case. A DNA match from one of the bodies was made to Vince Gunnels, who was a victim himself of Christopher Bush. But his DNA was on one of the bodies, a mitochondrial DNA match. So it's not nuclear, it's not as strong, but it's highly probable that it's him or someone in his family. And his DNA was found on one of the bodies. And Art Sloan, who is currently doing time from Las Stations, Vince Gunnels is doing time, but for drug-related crimes. He's never been charged with any sexual misconduct crimes or anything of the nature. Excuse me. Art Sloan is also doing time. Excuse me. And all these people should be looked at. They're living, and they have direct ties to this case.
You talk about the police cover-up in here, and again, you mentioned that there's powerful people here and there's motivation for people to, I guess, succumb to that influence. You are saying that there, as much as these tentacles reach far and wide, that you do mention a couple police officers in here that, again, loosely are tied in with all of these people. You can't really make a connection that this was, here are the orders and everyone's involved completely. It's a much bigger story of what likely happens all the time and what happened in this particular case. Yet, tell us a little bit more about the police connection in this.
Well, I'm not going to name any names that aren't right now, but I will say that there are some names in the book. I don't want to name them now on air because out of context of the other information, which I will likely leave out, some of it will seem as if I mean something other than what I mean. I will say this, though. In the book, everything is given context. So if a name is brought out, there's much greater context around that name for readers to understand. So that's important to me because you know, I don't by any means name a police officer, past or active, who I say was, you know, the Oakland County child killer, for instance, or had participation in these crimes, for instance. I will say this, though, in the book and here with you now, I do say that there is information to that leads one to believe, and one that approaches this case with a reasonable sense of things and a reasonable outlook, that leads one to believe that certain police officers were complicit in covering up or quashing or misdirecting people from the evidence. Now, it could be that they were told to, you know. It could be that they were being political in their actions. It could be that they were taking care of themselves and looking after their retirement package, and it could be that, you know, there are many reasons that police will not actively pursue something, and most of that is just like us at work. When you got a job and your boss tells you to stay away from something and you focus on that thing, you're going to lose your job. And in the case of police work, the stakes are much, much higher, obviously. When you have an active investigation at the time, anyway, back in the 70s and 80s, these are real kids. These are real people who were horribly murdered, and real family members who are really dependent on, not having rumor and speculation filter through to the news and such. I completely understand the initial narrative of police who were doing a good job. And I'm not saying all of them were. I'm saying the ones who were, I understand that initial narrative of, look, we can't talk about this. It's an active investigation. Completely understand that. I understand why they would do that socially, professionally. I understand all the reasons. At this time, 40 years later, those reasons don't hold anymore. What's the end game of you holding on to information or quashing evidence or misdirecting people? What's the end game? 100 years from now, nobody remembers the case? Because that's where that's going if you're allowed to do that. And that's why I wrote this book, and that's why other people look at this case. You don't get to say anymore that we're not allowed to tell you. But I will tell you specifically, it does look like at the time and throughout the years, people have continuously misdirected from the fact that there were very substantive leads concealed that would have led to an active prosecution had they not been concealed from even the cops. Some cops appear to have done some dirtier work. When people questioned the case, it appears that those questioning the case were sort of bullied into submission. It appears not just that outsiders to the case were bullied into submission, but it also appears that family members of the victims were bullied into submission. It appears, and I say it appears, but I also happen to know firsthand from stories from these people that they were when they pressed on certain leads that we know now without a doubt were substantive leads that should have been looked at, they were told those leads don't exist. They were told, I don't know what you're talking about. They were told, for instance, the Christopher Bush stuff. This stuff, I say it like it's common sense or common knowledge at this point. At this point, it is, sure. It's all online. Back in 2010, some of it started filtering out. Back when I initially released in 2015 an excerpt from my book, and I just laid it all out there. Since 2015, online, there's many versions of what I said about Christopher Bush and all these other people, because I let it out much before my book, because I was more interested in getting the information about the case out than I was in waiting for my book to get published so that people could read it. Right. This wasn't about pub date. You know, this was about here's what happened, and I got out what I could in 2015. The point is that the investigators on this case knew about so much information about some of these leads, and they consistently didn't tell, but lied about knowing to the family. So when the family members started to find out, they'd say, "Who is this Christopher Bush?" And they'd say, "This is not a lead. Christopher Bush is not a suspect." You know, they would say things like that. As it turns out, not only was he initially a suspect, but he remained a suspect. It turns out that the polygraph he allegedly passed, he actually failed. It turns out that Gregory Green actually failed the polygraph that he allegedly passed. It turns out, you know, when there's this list, as long as your kitchen counter, if you laid it all out, here's all the things that go wrong with this case. And it's not just Christopher Bush and Gregory Green. There's others. There are many people who were actively being looked at, and yet when the family members of the victim said, "Hey, I heard this thing that you're looking at so-and-so," they were told, "No, we're not looking at that person." We see now in internal correspondences obtained through FOIA demand that there were letters written to, say, the King family. When Barry King said, "I want to know about this," or when Kathy Broad, which is her last name now, but it was Timothy King's sister, when she says, I want to know this, the police say, "This doesn't exist. We don't know what you're talking about. Here's a letter I can show you. Here's a letter that was written to the police by the prosecutors that says, we don't know anything about this." That was written by the prosecutors to the King family that says, "We don't know anything about this." And yet, here's alongside it, I can place a letter right on the ground right next to it that's from internal correspondences between police saying they do know about it. So we have written, chronicled, you know, lies from the prosecutorial entities anyway, to the King family saying, "We don't know what you're talking about and you're wrong." We have internal police documents indicating the exact opposite, that the King family was right. But we have the official narrative not just being misdirected or quashed, but not being admitted to when called upon, right? So we have family members of the victims. You know, a young boy was murdered 40 years ago. His aging father, who is, you know, in his 80s, wants to know what happened. And he says to the police, "Hey, I know about this. Can you tell me more?" And they say to him, "We don't know what you're talking about." What's going on there? What's happening in this situation that the victim's family members have become the enemy to the investigation? How has this happened?
Yeah.
This is one of the leading questions of the book. Why has this happened?
Yeah. You write in the book that there's a school, Les Roses, in rural Switzerland, And you say it's the most expensive private school in the world, and students from 7 to 18 years of age. Winston Churchill attended, the Shah of Iran, Prince Edward, Rothschilds, Rockefellers, the Gettys, and Chris Bush. What is the importance of that, other than, tell us, what you think the importance is of something of that magnitude, Chris Bush going to that school, rubbing elbows with some of these people?
Yeah, and it was, so at the time, it wasn't just 17, 18-year-olds. I mean, we're talking, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, stuff like that. I mean, young people. It was like $100,000 a year. You know, I'm speaking in broad terms right now. But right now, I think if you look it up, it's like, $150 a year or something. You know, it's a private school that costs over $100,000 a year to send your kid, who's 12 years old to get an education, or 14 or 15 or whatever it is. And like you say, the descendants of the Rothschilds and the Churchills and the Shahs and the catch-up money, as they say, people who come from our biggest industries and our rulers and kings and queens and whatever, the descendants of those people go to school there. And, I mean, it's an amazing school. It sounds fantastic. They go horseback riding, they go hunting, all this stuff that you see in the movies that the rich do, the real rich. And that's what I'm talking about. There's a level of wealth that we see every day. Oh, that guy's driving a fancy Beamer. It's not the $40,000 BMW, it's the $100,000 BMW. That's not what we're talking about when we say Christopher Bush was wealthy. Well, that's not what we're talking about at all. People think rich. Now there's a million millionaires in America? Rich means nothing to people now. Sure, they want to be rich, but they don't quite understand the wealth that kings and queens and descendants of the Rockefellers and the Walmart franchise enterprise, these people, the wealth these people have is as we're seeing now in our political system. I won't get off on a large tangent, but we know that billionaires get away with big, 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 big crimes. And Christopher Bush, although his family was not valued in the billions at the time, because billionaire at the time was mostly unheard of. I mean, we had millionaires, but a couple hundred million back then was clearly what billions are now, and at least in buying power. But regardless, Christopher Bush was of that ilk. Christopher Bush was not just some guy who had a rich family. And it's not about the money, really. It's about the power and the access. You could look back at H. Lee Bush's wealth and say, Appleman doesn't know what he's talking about. H. Lee was only valued at $1 million or something. That's not the point. The point is Christopher Bush spent school days with the children of the most powerful people in the world. In the world. We're not talking about the rich elite of Detroit. We're talking about the freaking Shah of Iran, man. We're talking about the largest political power base in the world was who Christopher Bush mingled with. And so it's important to say how it doesn't make sense. He wouldn't get away with this. And I say, of course he would. Now, I'm not saying to you, Christopher Bush, I'm not going to say this right now for the sake of this conversation, Christopher Bush was the Oakland County child killer. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that Christopher Bush was never brought to task, was never tried, was never indicted, was never all of the things that, because of the power and access that he enjoyed through his family. If Christopher Bush today, and I'm not just focusing on Christopher Bush here, I'm going to talk about other things too, but if Christopher Bush specifically today were an African American man, he would be indicted on in America on 10% of what they already had on Christopher Bush. If you throw an African American poor man into court looking at multiple murders based on just anything that Christopher Bush had against him, that guy would probably go to prison. And that's an unfortunate statement about our criminal justice system, but the fact is Christopher Bush was looked at the way the elite are always looked at, the extreme elite. I'm not talking about people who are rich. I'm talking about the political elite. And he was looked at as that. Now you could say, well, what about the other people? that you say are involved in this case. I say to you that the other people were not looked at as well because they all led back to the politically entrenched. So you cannot say investigate, you know, if somebody is tied to Frank Sheldon, you know, millionaire, quote, philanthropist who serially molests children, if somebody is tied to that person, you cannot investigate that tie because it leads back to Frank Sheldon. So let's say Frank Sheldon's associate was not just molesting children at that camp, but was murdering them at that camp. Well, you're not going to investigate. Frank Sheldon's not going to let you investigate that guy for these murders at his camp. He can't let that happen because it leads back to him, right? Because it's his camp. So there's these associations that it's like that root system. When you pull up on a part of that root, the whole thing comes with it. And there are many reasons that this case wasn't looked at. Some of it is because good cops themselves got shafted. Good cops themselves were prevented from doing the investigative work that they needed to do. But the other reason, every time you look at it, it has to be that there's political powers at the time, and there were other people as well. You know, the prosecutor at the time made critical errors. Timothy King was not yet killed when Christopher Bush was in custody for these CSC charges. Christopher Bush was let out. Timothy King was later killed. You know, you have to wonder what the prosecutor at that time was thinking. How did they let this guy out? You know, was there political motivation for him to quash evidence, to misdirect? There's all kinds of stuff in this case. And what I can tell you without a doubt, if you put me on the stand and say, here's the only chance you get, say who did it, I can't necessarily do that, but I can tell you this. I can tell you this. Here's the million things nobody looked at, and it's not up to me as a non-official investigator, an author or a journalist looking into your case to try your case. It's up to you, and they haven't tried their case. So they say to me, you don't have all the information. I say to them, exactly. I say to them, I don't have all the information. Give it to me. Right, so I can tell you all the things, man, that lead one to speculate that this thing was just a dirty mess on purpose. But I depend on the police force to tell me where I've gone wrong, and they won't. I depend on the police force to tell me where I've gone right, got it right, and they won't. The police force remains quiet and probably always will until people like me and the person who comes along next and the person who comes along next continue to call them out on it. And that's what this case really needs at this point. I think this case at this point needs an outside investigator. You know, look, I'm not a policeman. I respect policemen for the work they do, and I know it's difficult, and you don't become one overnight. And I don't say at any time that I carry with me a 20-year background in homicide investigation. But it's clear as day to me everywhere this case went wrong and everybody who should have been looked at and all the lies that were told and all the suspects who were let go when all the evidence pointed to them. I mean, dude, there are reams and reams of evidence in this case, and we were told there was nothing. So this time I say an outside investigative body needs to come into this case, take it over with nobody who used to be on this case involved in it, and they'll probably solve this freaking thing in a year. I mean, it's clear as day. All you need is cops outside of the system of what they've got at this point. And I say cops, I just mean policing entities, prosecutorial entities, et cetera. There needs to be an outside investigative body come in and take over this case, and all the information is there. I can look at this case right now and tell you who would go to jail, but I can't for this case, but I can't do that legally because they haven't had their day in court, right? So that's the problem. I can tell you exactly what happened in 80% of this case. There's some holes because the police haven't provided the information. For instance, I have information like polygraph results. They say, here's the results of the polygraph. In answer to the question this person answered that. And it's all blacked out. So they gave the FOIA documents over, But in key moments, they key instances, they redacted the evidence, which is just a complete joke. But they sometimes forgot, man. This is where human interaction comes into play, or human error comes into play. They sometimes forgot. They redacted names. But if you scrub those, if you really look through those documents, I mean, and you eyeball this stuff for hours and days and weeks and months and in some instances years, suddenly you're like, wait a minute. I can't believe I skimmed this paragraph the first time because I thought it was something else. And there's the name. They forgot to redact because it's buried in there. There's the name, and there's the name that they redacted in 45 other instances, but here it is now, and now I know that's the name that they redacted. So, like, you have to dig and dig and dig, but it all makes sense. And on some instances, I would Google information that was redacted, but there were enough phrases that I could start to, like, based on that phrase, dig deep and deep. So I'm digging through phrases that have been half redacted, but eventually, if you dig hard enough, you find, but the thing is, why redact it? You ask for the information, they do not give it to you until they're forced to, almost by gunpoint, and then they give it to you, and then they don't apologize for lying to you for 20 years. And I mean, there are so many instances I can tell you that, I know we're off topic here, but so many instances where the family members of the victims have been led astray, have been stonewalled, have been just 100% lied to. Answer the question why. Why lie to the family members of the victims 40 years down the road? At the very least, how about bring them in, make them sign an NDA since they already told you what they know, and then discuss the thing that they just told you. You know, do it. You know, at risk of, jail time or something for violating that NDA. You know, I don't know. I don't know what police can do or can't do, but it seems to make sense. Mm-hmm. If a family member says to you, I know what happened here. I know you looked at this suspect. In fact, I even read the document. If you say to them, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, then clearly, there's other dealings at play that are making you say that to them. You do not need to lie to victims of murders and homicide and molestations and abductions. I mean, that's basically what they are. They're a victim by circumstance. I mean, it didn't happen to them, but you know, you're talking about somebody's father, somebody's sister, Kathy Broad gave her brother 30 cents to go buy candy. That was the last time she ever saw him alive. And you're going to lie to her 40 years later? You're going to lie to her and say, no, Christopher Bush was never a suspect? You're going to lie to her and say, we don't know anything about Fox Island? You're going to lie to her and say, I don't know, Lamborghini doesn't look like a suspect? You're going to lie to her? Like, you're just going to lie and lie and lie, and then all the documents seem to provide the exact opposite information? It's troubling, man.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service with this, exposing this story, basically laying it out, and you've come up with the kill jar, obsession, descent, and the hunt for Detroit's most notorious serial killer. And it's very interesting, Catherine Broad, as you mentioned, sister of Timothy King, cooperates incredibly and does the foreword for this book, and then Barry King too. Incredible interaction that you have, and your own journey that we just alluded to in the beginning. It's a very, very involved book. It's a fantastic book. I want to thank you very much, J. Reuben Appelman, for coming on and talking about it. For those of people who might want to take a look, do you have a website, Facebook page for this? Tell us about that.
Well, you can just go to my website, jrubenappelman.com. You have to spell it right, but if you Google it a few ways, you'll find out how to spell it. Or you can just go to, you can Google Appelman, the Kill Jar book. There's some other thing called the Killing Jar. That's not it. You can go to Simon & Schuster's page, the Kill Jar, Simon & Schuster website. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's in bookstores right now. You can just walk into your Barnes & Noble, especially in the Michigan area. It's saturated with the book right now, and there's also a TV show coming up that'll sometime in end of winter that is not called that. I'm not allowed to talk about the name or anything like that, but it will be out soon as well. And the book's also in audio, so if you're not a reader, you can just look for the audio.
That's great. I want to thank you very much, J. Reuben Appelman. You have a great evening. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for covering this. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.
Yes, sir.